She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And remember, we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And trust me when I say we are going to give you too much to think about today. But fear not, we'll be back and drip on you and sprinkle you with more things to think about. We have two unbelievably content-rich in-studio guests today. Jim Cook is the Executive Director of the Western National Parks Association, and Eric Penner Howery is the author of Edward Bridge Danson, Steward of the New West. It's great to have you both here today. I have to make a few announcements, and then we are going to get on with this very exciting show. And even though I'm from New Jersey and I talk fast, you guys might have to talk faster because you have a lot to share. So thank you to Fairfax Companies for being a sponsor of the Mrs. Green's World Show. We appreciate what you do, your support, and what you're doing for the planet. I'd like to also mention that Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Castle Rock Radio Networks, where my shows are broadcast weekly. And a shout out to one of our national sponsors, Ecobella. And if you're Googling it, I always like to mention it's Eco with two C's. Some people might say it Echo. I say it Eco. Consumers beware. What you are using for your personal care products, what are they and where do they come from? Are they sourced from fair trade? I say this every week and I hope you're all listening. Are they organic? Remember that you're putting them on your skin so they're being absorbed. Does the company you are purchasing whatever it is from, do they do animal testing? Do your homework and check out Ecobella. Nothing to worry about with them because they take care of all of that for us. I honestly use the products every single day. Please check them out at their website, www.ecobella.com. So important to support companies like this in this time. They don't have collapsing buildings with 1,000 people dying. And I would like you all to know that if you use the code Mrs. Green on checkout because you like what you see, you get 10% off your entire purchase. And who doesn't like that? So now, on with the show. Let's get started. Jim Cook, Executive Director of the Western National Parks Association, and Eric Penner Howery, author of Edward Bridge Danson, Steward of the New West. And I was talking to everybody before the show and saying, guys, what the heck did I do? We have like a four-hour series here, and I'm going to try and fit it into 1 hour. And then I decided, no, I'm not. We're going to get as much as we can done, get the guests and our listeners really excited, and then roll out some more content because a half hour for each of you will not hardly do it justice. I'm sitting there going down the rabbit hole doing the research and saying, what? I didn't know that. What? I didn't know that. What? I didn't know that. So, Jim, why don't we start with you, because it is really the distribution network for important works like Eric's, and I really don't think people have any idea. Most people, I'm just going to say that, what the role of the Western National Parks Association is. Let's set the stage by highlighting some of the important history starting in 1934. 1934 was when one person's vision started, I think. So go ahead. Tell us about Dale King.
Well, hi. First of all, thank you for having me on the show. This is a real pleasure, Gina. Yeah, indeed. So the vision for an association like ourselves started back in the 30s. In fact, actually before that, in the 20s, Yosemite Institute was the first, or Yosemite Association was the first cooperating association for the National Park Service. And over the years, a number of other cooperating associations formed to serve a very important role in helping the public really understand the resources that are represented in the national parks. You may know that the national parks have been around since 1916, they've never had the funding to fully fulfill their mission. So organizations like ourselves started cropping up starting in 1920 help explain to the public those resources at the parks, whether they were our natural resources or cultural resources. As you know, the national parks really represent the most important of our natural history across America, and truly the most important stories, the cultural heritage of our country. And so our organization has had a tradition of preparing and publishing materials, whether they're pamphlets, as simple as pamphlets, to more sophisticated full publications. And these are available at the national parks when visitors show up. So that's the important vision that Dale King had. He was aware of what a few of the other parks that were doing back in those early fledgling days of the National Park Service. And in our case, Mr. King and the other leaders of the Southwest Monuments Group decided to form this nonprofit organization, at that time called the Southwest Monuments Association.
Right. You've had quite a few names.
Right.
I noticed that in the history.
So the association was formed officially in 1938, and it was this group of national monuments. Back in those days, the National Park Service rangers really, their primary focus was on protecting the resources. The monuments of our group in particular were subject to a lot of folks who were hunting antiquities and taking them. So really those rangers were spending most of their time simply protecting those resources. And more people were learning about the parks and began to visit those parks also to learn about what was going on. And so these materials were developed to serve that very important function of explaining why the park or the monument or historic site was significant. What was the national significance of this particular place?
And was that in the, when it said a lot in the reading I did, it was the interpretive, it said, you know, providing interpretive services. Was that literally when people came to the park, like if you go to Grand Canyon, there are people that are giving presentations and you sit and really have a wonderful way to learn and interact and ask questions. So was that what they were doing in addition to almost policing to make sure that nobody stole artifacts out of really important national park sites?
Exactly. So the rangers at national parks truly serve many, many functions. They are there to protect the resource, but they're also there to educate the public and interpret those resources, as you've stated. That's exactly the word that's used. It's like going to a museum. You have a interaction either with a person or a brochure or some sort of written language that talks about those resources. So in those in our case, we employ subject matter experts. Often there are scholars who will look at that particular resource and interpret that for the public in language that most people can understand and appreciate.
And they have people like that when you go to national parks. We've gone to quite a few. They're really passionate. So it's not like hearing a science presentation, which the average person doesn't necessarily want to hear. Throw in science, but make me sure that I can understand it. So they're the people that I've ever heard present. You hire them because they have such a passion for what they're doing and it ignites your passion for why you're there and what you want to learn.
Exactly. It's a real art form to translate often very, very heady scientific information, dense material, and present it in a way that's approachable and understandable and makes you appreciate whatever it is that the subject is.
And, you know, a little piece of history that excited me, and I think it will our listeners, because of how things have changed. In the beginning, the founders with the way that it was started, the Southwest Monuments Association, providing those brochures, it was such a different time back then. So people actually took them home and put them in their libraries, which most people we don't, you know, oh, we'll visit you in our library. And what happened is it ignited passion for other people. They came in and they hadn't been to the park and they read the brochures. So it really was helping build the momentum for what it is today. To me, it was like, here was a very definite life-changing. It started to have a ripple effect because of the vision of the founders. Let's put it into printed word, and it started spreading what we would call virally now, really one person at a time. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. Well stated.
So after World War II, which is in there, I mean, I think people really like to know the history. There were things definitely slowed down. Again, another committed volunteer kept it going. And I think his name was Nate Dodge. It doesn't matter, but he kept it going. Another one with a passion. And then Dale King came back and things started to really, I would say relatively, it's a good word to use, is skyrocket. It came to, of all places, Globe, Arizona, which is not a big hot spot for visitors. It's the way to get to the White Mountains. But it really was that where the national headquarters started, correct?
Well, yes. The organization moved to Globe, Arizona, and was headquartered there for quite a number of years. And there was an important reason for that, in that the National Park Service had a regional archaeological center there. So
Right. Given
many of the parks that we work with have significant archaeology assets, it made a lot of sense. And a lot of the Park Service at that time, we were pretty commingled with the Park Service in terms of our board and staff, and so it was a logical place for us to be at the time.
And it is strategically placed when you think. I mean, it's easy to get to from Phoenix. It's easy to get to from Tucson. There's access to the White Mountains and a lot of the reservation areas, so that does make sense. Okay, let's fast forward a little bit, because I think, again, enhancing the history and getting people familiar with how this all came to be. Can you tell us a little bit about Mission 66? I thought that was very intriguing.
Well, Mission 66 was an initiative of the National Park Service to reinvigorate the visitor experience primarily. So we saw a lot of visitor centers being built at that time. And you can still see, when you go to a national park, often you'll see visitor center designed and built during that period.
And then that started then, and there was a huge 10-year plan to make it happen. So then what happened? There have been moves, and one of the things that I marked in my notes is that there was a point in history, and you guys really thank you for providing such good research, where the Congress really put it wasn't on hiatus, but there was a division, and Tucson got started and Phoenix got started. I mean, I can find it in my notes. There were many notes, and I wanted to cover a lot. Let me see. Luis Castellum, okay, he performed the audit, and things started to really move forward then, and the money started to roll in, which helped solidify. Okay, here it is. In June 1957, the National Park Service again terminated the Southwest Monuments Group office, and almost all of the staff was divided between Tucson, the Western Archaeological Center, and the NPS regional office in Santa Fe. And at that point, Dale King decided to leave, and I'd like to know what he was doing. He started his own publication company. Is that what he did?
That's what I understand, yes.
Okay. So was that a deciding moment because now your headquarters is in Tucson. Was that the beginning?
Well, the organization had a presence also in Santa Fe at one point. The move to Tucson actually took place in 1982, and we had a presence in downtown Tucson for many years in a wonderful facility called the Stork's Nest. It was the first maternity ward of Tucson, wonderful old adobe facility.
Yes.
And in 2002, the organization built its own headquarters up in Oro Valley, where we now enjoy
16,000 square feet.
Yeah, where we now enjoy a really wonderful space, not only housing our administrative staff, but we also have a wonderful store there. It's a 2,000 square foot retail facility with a large venue where we do weekly programs. So twice a week on Wednesdays and Saturdays, we offer free high quality programming that is focused on national parks, excuse me, or subjects that relate to national parks in some fashion. So there are lectures, book signings, all kinds of different events that engage people in the stories of the national parks. We also are beginning to offer educational tours to national parks. We've been to the Oregon Pike National Monument. We've been to Saguaro National Park. We've been to Gila Cliff Dwellings just last weekend. And we've got a whole
Beautiful.
Schedule coming up. So we also are offering a few classes. We've been working with Native American basket weavers and have had great success with that. Flute, how to play Native American flute, and other workshops and things of that nature. We also host about 12 special sales shows per year that have a strong educational component. For example, one of the national parks that we are affiliated with is the Hubble Trading Post, which I'm sure you're going to hear a little bit more about later from Eric here.
I am going to ask about the Hubble Trading Post. Eric, thanks for being so patient, but it will be all about you.
So the Hubble, the trader comes down to Tucson and puts on a demonstration, and it's really a great experience. People flock to the store to learn about the art of Navajo rug weaving and other craft that are represented there at the Hubble.
And I think we can say it now because it certainly merits repeating later on in the show. But in 1957, here we'll bring in the Ned Danson story, Dr. Ned Danson. He was then the assistant director of the Museum of Northern Arizona, and he was on the advisory board of the National Parks Association. And he's the one that proposed that the Hubble Trading Post on the Navajo Reservation become a National Historic Site. Not so easy then. And didn't pass right away, correct if I read all of Eric's really good notes. He was, again, very tenacious about making that happen. A name that in Arizona we certainly know and love, Stuart Udall, introduced the legislation, and eventually that became one of the national sites. Was that a defining moment, do you think, in the history of the Western National Parks Association, or was it just another layer to move it forward?
I think, yes, I think it was a significant move from a number of perspectives. Number one, the Hubble Trading Post is such a unique historic site and was preserved to retain the cultural dimension, not just it's not like a typical museum where it's kind of captured
in time.
It's an
active living trading post.
Exactly. That was what the vision was, to retain that vision. And so,
don't take all my thunder, Jim.
There's Eric. I love it. This is great. Okay, we will get to that. You can be sure we will. But it is really, people get ADD, so they'll listen twice to about how important the Hubble Trading Post is. I promise, Eric. Okay. But it was controversial. And people didn't understand, from what I read. People really didn't understand. So we'll leave that for so we don't steal Eric's thunder. But eventually it did get passed.
Yes. And we still operate it today, obviously, with the National Park Service. But our role is to operate the trading post. And every day we're buying and selling native craft. It's a really great place to visit.
And believe me, at my age, there are many of us that wish we had bought Navajo rugs 30 or 40 years ago, because then we'd have some. It's like some of our friends did.
You can still do it.
You can still do it, right, at a little bit of a markup compared to when it was 40 years ago. But they're such, talk about a treasure, a national treasure, and works of art, each and every one of them. Okay, so the staff grew. I think we can talk a little bit about that, because to me it's amazing how what started out as publications in national parks has grown to a 16,000 square foot building, includes many other parks throughout the country, the Western region specifically, and from what my notes say, the association constructed its own building in Globe. In 1977, the Department of Interior recommended that the memorandums of agreement be negotiated with each cooperating association, and that the association maintain distinct management authorities. So to me, that's important to mention, because then you kind of became the master of your fate, the captain of your own ship. There were things that had to be put in place so that it was like, okay, we're here, we're really here, and we're taking care of our own stuff. Is that fair to say?
Yes, exactly. The tradition of having National Park Service employees as a component of these cooperating associations was very important, I think, in the early days. But at that point in time, there was a recognition that it made sense to have a very distinct a relationship between nonprofit entity versus the governmental partner. So that was that's what you're referring
to.
It
doesn't just happen easily, because you had to get the money raised was considered a donation. How does the government take a donation? And yet the works, the money was helping to support even the national park staying open. I don't think that's an exaggeration. There were pretty lean times when this money was the bread and butter to keep the parks going, and now look what you've done.
And that's still the case. The National Park Service truly relies on its nonprofit partners such as ourselves to sustain its operations and enhance the visitor's experience.
And when we first started communicating via email about your being on the show, and I started reading it, and I feel like I'm a above average, well-informed individual because I'm Mrs. Green, I was like, what? They just really sell books and publications, and it's really not the Western National Parks Association that I would think would be like caretakers of the park, for example. You're not the caretaker. So to me, I think our listeners are going to be very intrigued about the magnificent role you play.
They also fund research. That's another thing they
also
do.
Fund research. So there you go. Another show. What can I say? Keep bringing things up, Eric. That's all we need. Is that there are many other things to do. Okay, we're going to take a short break. Time is flying. I knew that would happen. We have with us Jim Cook, who is the executive director of the Western National Parks Association, and Eric Penner Howery, author of the book. Okay, let me get the book, Eric. Edward Bridge Danson, Steward of the New West. We'll be right back, and we'll get on with the show. Please stay with me. This is Green's World Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Can you predict the future? The reality is we can't, but we can be ready for it. Funded by the National Science Foundation, researchers at the University of Arizona are working on a $3 million project to study the monsoon and learn about our changing desert weather, climate, and ecology. Such knowledge will help guide us to a more sustainable future, not just for our desert, but for the world. Now that's thinking ahead. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. The 2013 VW Jetta TDI is the sedan people love to love. It comes with a zippy turbocharged diesel engine that's 90% cleaner burning than previous diesel engines, and it goes farther on a tank of gas than a Toyota Prius. Chapman Volkswagen has a great selection of Jetta TDIs, so choose yours today at ChapmanTucson.com or in person at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson.
You can always find things around the house to give to Goodwill, but I have a bigger reason to give. My brother, Jim. When Jim was just 6 weeks old, he had a stroke. He had to rewire his brain to do most things we all take for granted. Thanks to Goodwill, Jim has a job and a sense of purpose. You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives? Well, it's true. Goodwill is the best thing that ever happened to Jim. Please donate today.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just three reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
Yeah.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And someday we will have video, and then all of you will get to see our in-studio guest and Mrs. Green dance to the music. It always makes me, it just perks up my mood. Not that I need mood perking up very often, but very excited to have two in-studio guests today, Jim Cook, Executive Director of the Western National Parks Association, and Eric Penner Howery, author of Edward Bridge Danson, Steward of the New West. Great to have you both here. Time is flying. So, Jim, even though I know there are five more shows here, we're going to give you about five more minutes, or Eric might choke me, and I wouldn't blame him. It's like, not kidding. I don't think he's a violent person. I don't think he'd choke me. But we have a lot of exciting things to cover with him. So talk about, we will fill in more dots. There's the 16,000 square foot facility. You're doing classes, you're doing presentations, you've started doing tours. Give us a little snapshot or look into the future of what some of your plans are for the Western National Parks Association.
Great, thank you. So we've talked about our publications, and those have been very important for the National Park Service for many, many years. Excuse me. Another part of our mission, or what we do, is we operate the nonprofit stores that you see and experience in National Park Visitor Centers. So we work with 66 national parks in 12 Western states. And so people, when they go to a national park, they often interact with our staff. Another important component is our research program that Eric mentioned. We have funded research, important research programs in the national parks for many, many years. So we're helping the parks understand the resources, which helps ultimately in interpreting those resources.
And just give me one example of a research project you would fund.
Sure.
Or have funded.
Locally, you know of our Saguaro National Park,
right.
And we have funded buffelgrass research, which you may know is
Beat
an
back
invasive
buffelgrass
species.
Was one of my most listened to shows.
Okay.
Beat
yeah.
back buffelgrass.
So we've helped fund research on that. I'd like to talk a little bit about the future and this very important challenge that we face, which is this country is shifting. The whole world is shifting, as we know. People interact with information and gather their information in different ways now. So we have a very important strategic initiative to make sure that our products are relevant into the future, and that parks remain relevant into the future. So we are focusing on new media and getting out on the web in new ways, developing a whole program in that respect. We're also focusing on youth and urban and diverse audiences.
Wonderful.
This is really important.
Huge.
We fear that more and more people know less and less about national parks. And as I stated earlier in the program, our parks really do represent the most important parts of America. They really tell the American story. And we believe everybody has a place in that story, but they don't know about it. So we are also focusing on bringing the parks to the people, if you will, both virtually and in very real ways, where we are focusing on large urban areas, where we hope to create a presence and programs in large urban markets. We are bringing kids into the parks and providing in-park camping experiences and other types of science-based programs so that families, people of diverse backgrounds, kids have a visceral connection to the parks, because if you're like me, you probably went to parks as a kid, and those are lifelong connections.
And then took my kids because I went as a kid.
Exactly. And so that's what we are trying to address with those changing demographics, with the changes in the way people are interacting with media. We need to make sure that people have that kind of personal experience in the parks. So we're hoping to hook the idea through the internet and through other types of new media, grab their attention. For example, imagine some youngster in Chicago who is studying the history of America and lands on our website that talks about the Brown versus Board of Education story. That's one of the national historic sites that we work with in Topeka, Kansas, that has national, if not global, cultural relevance. And if we can hook that kid into that story, we might be able to hook them also into the other stories of the national parks.
So is part of the strategy connecting with schools also? Because
yes,
that's where you meet the kids and can have access to them. Is that one part of the strategy?
Absolutely.
And let's mention your website before we go to Eric. We're going to have to go in about 1 minute. Let's mention your website, and we will be talking more about it. I just have to say quickly that over the time of this show, the surprise thing to me is people on and kids that I've had on where they don't even know that they can go onto the University of Arizona campus. So going to a national park, maybe not on the radar. I applaud that so much. And then it opens the world to them. LA, and when I went to Monterey, there's kids that live in Salinas where it's farm country all over. The kids in Salinas, some of them never been to a farm, never seen a working farm, friends of the farmers. So it's so real what you're doing. And to me, so important so that we pass it on. It's just some of my best memories of my life. Okay, now we're going to go mid-show right into Eric Penner-Howery, who has lots to share. I'm bursting. He's bursting. He's the author of The Edward Bridge Danson, Steward of the New West. And Eric, thank you so much for your patience and for sitting there quietly while we kind of laid the groundwork for one of the ways you get the word out about you.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you're very welcome. I'm glad to be here. I appreciate it very much. And we eventually, both the two of us are on this show in part because of a presentation that I did and my uncle did.
That, uncle Ted.
Yes.
That. The famous Sam Malone. That's what I said to him. I said, Ted, you have to say that on the show when I interviewed him. Like, everybody knows Cheers. I'm still looking for my Cheers. So
yes.
Go ahead.
But we were at the Tucson Festival of Books a few months ago, hosted by the Western National Parks Association. And one of the things in preparing this presentation that I realized is that Jim has the challenge, the extra challenge, of not only having a really great organization, but as you yourself said, a hard to understand and hard to explain organization. And one of the things when he talked about it that they are doing to try to explain it is to share the stories of people who have experienced going to parks, or even before they were parks, just the land, the historical sites, whatever they may be. And my grandfather's story, this is because it's a biography of my grandfather, Edward Bridge Danson Jr. Ted is the third, and of course there's a first before him. And his story is an example of how parks and just the landscape or historical places or whatever it may be can inspire a person's life. And so that was...
And that puts it right where I want to start, because you have an impressive family history, but I want to add my voice to say you are impressive in and of yourself because you wrote the book. And you know how many people I know that are going to write a book? Well, you wrote the book, and I've had several friends, one of whom wanted to be here today, talk to me about what a great book, and can she get your autograph? So it was really, let's start about you. I said when you came in, you were marked at birth, that you had to be telling stories because of your grandparents. So can you just give a little bit of history of you and how you came to write the book?
Okay, let's see. So, let's see, which way should I start? I guess I'll start that, But the way I could say it, my parents don't know when they met because they both met when they were so young. My father's father, who is Emil Howery, a professor at head of the Department of
Very
Anthropology,
famous.
Yes, down at the University of Arizona here, there's a Howery building.
Right.
right on the campus. And Emil Howery, fat grandfather, was the mentor of my other grandfather, Ned Danson, who I wrote this book about. And so it was a very remarkable situation whereby you usually have stories of competing in-laws as the stereotype. Well, that wasn't the case at all, because my two grandfathers and my grandmothers were all close friends before they were true. They connected.
And that's what
family.
They wanted to talk about,
yeah.
Which is they
yeah.
shared a passion.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, so when I was young and we'd all get together and all of us were together, usually my grandfathers would talk about all these colleagues that I didn't really know about, and it could get a bit confusing. But now I would know at least a few more of them. That's one of the things. So I guess what I'll say is that My grandfather, Ned Danson, so Ted's father, was, for most of his career, he was director of the Museum of Northern Arizona in Flagstaff. and I'll talk about more in detail later. But in recent years, there's an academic chair in his name, and there was a goal to do fundraising for that academic chair. And one of the things we thought of is to have the biography to share his story.
Right. Let's write a book.
Yeah. Yeah. And so and museum served as publisher, and then we had a fundraiser with the book and Ted's presence bringing attention to the museum. Then we found a way to get into Western National Parks Association to their bookstore and to have this special event in Tucson, in the book festival in Tucson.
Ever so worthy.
Yeah,
I know,
you.
Really. But let's talk about, you wrote really fun notes that made me, I don't have a copy of the book yet. So let's talk about, Ned.
Jim
had,
can fix that.
Jim, I'll be expecting that. But then I got to go see Eric so he can autograph it. It's just, okay, we'll make it all happen. So Ned was quite the colorful character growing up. And just tell a little bit, like, I do love the story about when he was driving.
Okay.
And you did highlight that. And you can feel very free to read a little bit from the book because it just enriches the experience. I did it.
Okay, so suffice to say that he was born in Cincinnati, Glendale or Cincinnati, depending on which you want to say, Ohio. And from a fairly well-to-do family, so they had a fair number of cars. And at least a few.
Really was significant.
Yeah, it was significant. And also he would drive when he was single-digit age. He'd drive his mother North Carolina because there were no driver's licenses back then. But he was also a thing that was only starting to develop was the concept of safe driving.
right. And I'm not sure he was like buying into that at first from the stories
you told.
Certainly
not at first. Let me... Away.
But basically, when you find it, we can talk about it. He was driving.
Okay, I saw the picture of the Yankee mother. All right. So, okay, he'd just taken a trip to Japan, actually. So back in the United States, Danson continued his life of high style and lackluster academics until a foolish stunt with his car radically altered his life. Just before Halloween in 1933, he and one of his Allen cousins raced to school in their cars, as they often did. Years later, he recalled what happened. I didn't know that the front tires of my car were smooth, and in taking the curve on Clifton Hill, the front end didn't go around the bend. It simply shot across the road. My cousin, who was behind me, passed me on the right laughing. Three cars were coming down the hill towards me went off into somebody's lawn. I put the car into first and tore after my cousin. By the time Ned left school that afternoon, he had forgotten the incident. Upon his return home, he found his mother, stern-faced, waiting for him at the door. Danson recalled, "My mother was a very handsome woman, but sometimes she could be like a black cloud, and she was very like a black kind of cloud that night. She held out her hand, saying, 'I want the keys, please,' and then informed her son that he would not be allowed to drive for the next month. When he protested that he had a date for the big dance that weekend, she replied, 'I believe you skidded this morning.' 'How did you know?' Danson asked. 'I was in the third car.'"
I love that.
She told him.
Busted. Yeah. Like, truly busted. It's the little birdie told me, I was a little birdie. Okay.
Yeah. After a long argument in which he recalled that his mother wasn't giving an inch, the telephone rang. His mother went to answer it. The man on the other end was Rufus Southworth, the doctor who had delivered Danson. He was calling to make an offer to the young man he had helped bring into the world. When the conversation ended, Mrs. Danson returned to her son with a choice. Either he could be grounded for a month, or he could join Dr. Southworth as part of the crew of the schooner Yankee, which was about to leave for an 18-month voyage circumnavigating the world. "Maybe it's time you got away," he recalled her saying. "I don't know that I can handle you alone." Ned Danson and his mother arrived at the port of Gloucester, Massachusetts, a few days before the ship was to sail.
Now, I just love that. And I have to say that we have guests in studio because this is Mrs. Green's World. So Eric's parents are here rigorously shaking their head and loving it. I'm thrilled to have you both here. I wish we had more microphones so you could just say hello. But proud parents and wonderful to have them here. So that was...
parents and also very stickler editors as well. Since they, both of them in this case, lived a lot of the things.
And you're still all talking to each other and one big happy family. That was a defining experience, I am sure.
I think so.
So he said, "Yes, I don't want to be grounded for a month. I'm going on this 1.5-year journey," which was life-changing.
Oh, absolutely. It was, there was the subtler things that he did. He had to. It was not just going on the ship.
He had to work.
He had to work.
He wasn't in first class. No, he was more like in steerage.
Yeah. And it was well, everyone was in steerage.
That's right. It was not a luxury liner.
Yeah, everyone but the cook had to take watch. And so he did start learning the responsibility that he would later use in the Southwest and at the museum. But it was also a time before a lot of things changed. But one of the things I keep... It's amazing how World War II changed so much
so around much.
The world. I mean, so many cultural things ended, things you wouldn't expect. And so he saw sort of the last time before a big shift in all the world culture. He saw all sorts of things. He went to Bali and saw one of the last mass cremations. Back then. He went to Bali. There was an Angkor Wat. All sorts of places. It's amazing.
Back then, and he wasn't putting those pictures up on Facebook either.
No.
He had to write a lot about the history. I mean, that's what people had to do back then.
And he was just fascinated by what he saw. Everything from he met descendants of Fletcher Christian on Pitcairn.
Oh my gosh, you got to be kidding me. So it's almost like into going into the military, only he had a different kind of freedom.
Of course, he later did that too.
That's true. But he really, it's a time for him to grow up.
Yeah.
Did he break anybody's heart? I don't remember seeing that in your notes when he left. Not that we know of.
Not that we know of.
Okay, there's head shaking all around. Okay, so he went on the schooner. That was a really good piece of it. And then he actually decided to studied and fell in love with anthropology at the University of Arizona in 1938. Now, did I miss an important chapter?
Well, just the fact that I don't know if are we getting close to the end.
We're getting close to a break, so we just have to have a short break, and maybe we should come back with that passage. So, everybody, you can tell there's a lot of excitement here. You are listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. In studio with me today are Jim Cook, Executive Director of the Western National Parks Association, and Eric Penner Howery, author of Edward Bridge Danson, Steward of the New West. Jim, very quickly, give your website, because we're going to do that a lot when we tweet and do that. So let's do that really quickly.
WNPA.org.
WNPA, Western National Parks Association.org. Okay. And Eric, we're going to talk about where people can get copies of your book. We'll be right back. Please stay here with me. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. We're learning a lot and having a lot of fun.
She's the most exciting thing that's ever happened to you, and you want to spend eternity with her. She deserves nothing less than the best, an Abbott Taylor original. A diamond engagement ring as exceptional as she is that will make her eyes sparkle every time she sees it. Because we design and make our own jewelry, we can create something wonderful for every budget. I'm Abbott Taylor. I'd like to invite you to come see what Abbott Taylor Jewelers has waiting for you. With 35 years and thousands of original jewelry designs, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. We're proud to say using recycled gold, we have saved over 100 million pounds of toxic waste from this planet. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook, and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
It's got advanced technology. It's got major breakthroughs in technology everywhere you look. It's the 2013 Honda Accord. Hi there, this is Mrs. Green, and I want to share with you that after nearly 40 years of heritage, this is the most stunning Accord ever. The highly respected Automotive Magazine raves that the 2013 Honda Accord offers unparalleled talent of goodness. Please visit Chapman Honda at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson to check it out and see for yourself.
Can academic research really save the planet? This year, the University of Arizona took full ownership of Biosphere 2. With 5 ecosystems enclosed in over 7 million cubic feet of sealed glass, Biosphere 2 is a premier facility for environmental research, where the top minds in the world will come together to address some of humanity's greatest challenges, such as climate change. Now that's using your brains. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Did you know that even a donated doorknob can help Habitat for Humanity? Habitat's Habistore accepts donated items like furniture, building materials, and appliances. Donations come from commercial builders, malls, restaurants, hotels, and individuals like you. Then, items are bought by bargain hunters who come across the very things they are looking for, just like the right doorknob. The best part is that Habistore sales generate funds for building homes. Call 520-889-7200 or visit HabitatTucson.org.
But emphasize us.
Yeah, yeah. It's on Amazon.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I often wonder if you can tell that by all of this thinking, I always have a big grin on my face. It's like I'm so alive with the content we have, the quality of the guests in studio today are second to none. And I mean that. It's just so fun. It's exciting, and the time is flying. Jim Cook, Executive Director of the Western National Parks Association, and Eric Penner Howery, author of Edward Bridge Danson, Steward of the New West. So, Eric, we've got about 15 more minutes. Let's leap to your grandfather. Yes. And you have two famous grandfathers. So, and you have a famous father and a famous mother, because she's helped. They're making it all happen, because it doesn't happen alone. I know this is really true. So let's leap forward to when Ned fell in love with Arizona. Yes. And you have a passage to read.
So he came back. He came back from his adventures on the seas.
And he's all grown up now.
Well, except that he sort of went back to his old ways of being, he had always loved reading what he liked, but he didn't study if it was boring him. So he was...
I understand that.
But so anyway, his uncle, one of his uncles had bought land just near Tubac. He created a place called Kenyon Ranch. It was a dude ranch then. It's now there as a retreat center. And so, but he needed people to help finish building the
place. Right.
So a bunch of my grandfather and a bunch of his cousins all got together to drive out to build it. So they drove out to Arizona in July 1937. Their car, which Danson remembered was a Ford sedan, he always remembered the cars he owned. So the Ford sedan boiled over every 50 miles during the Texas leg of their trip, which led them to try driving at night. Thus Danson, open quotation marks, was awake at 5 in the morning as we came out of the canyon west of Bisbee and up the plateau to Tombstone. He recalled that there was a pink and blue pre-sunrise sky with some fleecy white clouds, a hill with a coyote on it. I know it's melodramatic, but that's the way it was. It was there that I fell in love with Arizona, Danson wrote. Somehow I knew that Arizona was going to be my home. And Arizona's the one place, there are many places, but if you think to WMPA for a minute, that's the feeling that you carry. If it's not, it can be historical, or the land, the love of the land, it strikes you, and you can learn after that. You can find out what it means, what the science is, what the people were
like. But you're hooked.
Yeah, hooked. And that's what they're trying to do, and that's even without a national park there at the time, just the land itself did to my grandfather.
So the Reader's Digest version, so we can work up to the museum in Flagstaff, because I want listeners to know how he got from the University of Arizona and what he did there to a fabulous museum.
So he started living in Kenyon Ranch, started taking classes in the University of Arizona. His favorite one was anthropology, taught by Emil Howery, my other grandfather. And he was interrupted by war, but he finished his training. At that time, he was married, and when he finished his training, he had two children, my mother and my Uncle Ted. And he was a professor for a brief time, first in Colorado, very briefly, then he was brought back to University of Arizona and taught here. And then there was an institution, he started serving on the board of an institution called the Museum of Northern Arizona, which is in Flagstaff, Arizona. The focus of the museum is to study the Colorado Plateau, which is a geographical region, the Grand Canyon is a part of it.
Right.
All four states and the four corners have a part of it, are a part of it to some degree. So. And the original director, a man named Harold Colton, was feeling that he was getting close to wanting to retire, and they needed a new assistant director to learn from him, who would then take over when Colton left. So there's a scene of a car ride with all four people in the car, my grandparents, in which
wow.
They, Emil Howery was asked, well, who do you think should be the new director or the assistant director to be director? And he pointed straight at my grandfather, my other grandfather.
And they had some juice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They before they were family, they were close friends for many years, even after the training. And so they moved from the low desert here to the high desert in Flagstaff. And my grandfather and my grandmother, my family, they moved into a homestead. It's called the homestead. Technically, the McMillan homestead is the oldest building in Flagstaff. That's, you know, there you could look and see the ground through the floorboards.
Rustic.
Yeah, rustic. And that was on the campus of the Museum of Northern Arizona. There was a road running between that, and they had the museum on one side, which was where they displayed things. Then on the same side with the homestead was the research center. Like WMPA, the museum has displays, it does presentations, but it also funded a lot of research, all sorts of research from around the Colorado Plateau. It's amazing the things they've done. And I can go back to that to make sure we covered Hubble Trading Post. Before he became, when Colton was still director, when he was learning the ropes.
Right.
They went out to the Navajo Reservation and they went to the Hubble Trading Post, then owned by the Hubble family, who would, I think there's a second generation of owning it. And the widow of the previous, of the man who had inherited it, was feeling it's getting too much for her. She didn't want to sell the place. This is obviously a trading post for quite a while. These were very important cultural places for the Navajo
pieces residents. Of our history, yeah. Of American history, so important.
And it's where things like the Navajo rugs that became
right
known to Americans in the outside part of America would. It's where they were funneled through. Essentially, they came. The Navajo would trade it to the traders. The traders would trade some of it out to the rest of the country and the world, and that's how it became known. But it was a wonderful place with wonderful art too, specifically the Hubble Trading Post.
So Ned fell in love with it. I mean, it's just another piece.
Even before, as a child, he had come out on one of the train trips, and he had, as a child, spent a night in the Hubble Trading Post, and he'd had a wonderful time as a 9-year-old just going around the Southwest.
And let me just think about it. I'm from New Jersey.
Yeah.
When I came out to the Southwest, and there were, I mean, I'm going to be honest, like Indians, and not to mention, this was wild country, and horses, and I mean, I did not grow up with a horse in my backyard and all of that. So the period in history when he was visiting there, not every kid in America was going to see the piece of Americana that's so important.
Dorothy Hubble said, could we sell this to the museum? And Grampy and Colton talked themselves, and it just didn't feel like something the museum could handle. They wanted to have, it wasn't in their purview. But my grandfather had just been put on the advisory panel for the National Park Service. They advised the Secretary of the Interior which sites to include into the Park Service. And he thought, you know, maybe it could be in the Park Service. And this went many years of trying to get a bill passed to get it in there. I could go into details, but I don't think we have the time. But just say he took a lot of effort to convince he had to get through Congress. There are some congressional people who are very suspicious of the whole endeavor.
And it wasn't a natural fit. So he was really trying to do something that was an early adopter kind of thing to do.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of foresight.
And the other thing, I don't think it was at the very beginning that he thought this, but during the process, it was decided that they didn't just want to take the building. They didn't just want to take that and show it.
Right.
Lovely as the place as it is, lovely building as it is. They wanted to make it continue to be an active trading
post. The experience.
Yes, to keep that alive. And it took a while. He went to the congressional delegation in Arizona. Barry Goldwater who had also visited there many times.
Right.
Supported it. So did Carl Hayden, who was the other senator at the time. So we had a Democrat and a Republican, both believing this needs to be preserved and working together. And, of course, Stuart Udall, who was in Congress then. It was when Stuart Udall was Secretary of the Interior himself that the bill was finally signed. I want to pause one thing. There was one time when the bill almost got really close to being signed, to make it a park. But there was another potential site that was to be in the park, so it was called Fort Bowie, I believe that's how it's pronounced. That is, it's a obviously more historical site. Well, that was a historical site too, but And really, it didn't seem right for Arizona to get two at the same time. My grandfather looked at the information, said, you know, Bowie's a bit more important. So he held back on Hubble for that year, and then went, and only after Bowie was passed did he support the Hubble Trading Post. So really, one of the things, amazing thing is how much he put the big picture over his projects. That's one of the things I really liked about what he did. But anyway, eventually, Hubble Trading Post was included into the National Park Service, but the thing is, the National Park Service, it was a bit weird to have them running a trading post. But my grandfather was also on the board of something that I believe at that time was called the Southwest Parks and Monuments Association, which is WMPA now. And so, and the amazing thing is, he had
that's the integration of the show and having you both on together. There's a lot of intertwined pieces to this.
And you have this thing where he was doing all of one, essentially this was one project, but he did it as a museum director, eventually director, as on this one board for the Secretary of the Interior, and then for this independent Southwest Parks and Monuments Association. It was his passion. I read that passage to talk about how he found his passion. He found this place that he loved, and then he, through his training in anthropology, he learned about it. As museum director, became close friends with Hopi, Navajo, ranchers, politicians in Congress, and in the just local and state politicians, and they all ranchers of the local family. And all he had, I talked about him not being great at academics. He read what he liked before. He studied things if it interested him. What happened is he found something that interested him, and it changed his life from being someone who could have just drifted and maybe had a job but not really done.
And maybe he had a lot of fun.
Yeah, he had fun. Oh,
he sounded like a lot of fun.
He had fun. interacting with people, just, you know, coming up with ways to all these things with Dorothy Hubble, a close friend, working with people at SPMA, now WMPA, close friends. I mean, Udall, Goldwater. We went through the research. We looked through the correspondence and the writings between Goldwater and my grandfather. Really, they were close friends. He found something he loved, and that thing that he loved was involved preserving the sites that people could then find their passion in return. And so,
it's a legacy, and we've talked about what legacy we're going to have. And the thing that impresses me always when doing the show and just in life in general is when someone then really sees the future for what's important to preserve and they start doing it. Yeah. Because if he hadn't, lots of pieces of history could already be lost. Oh, yeah. And who doesn't go to a national park? I go down the rabbit hole. I mean, I'm lost and I want to read everything and I want to look at the maps and I want to see about the flora and the fauna. And if people before me didn't think to preserve that. I mean, my husband and I, we go on drive-thrus to the Saguaro East to just see the cactus when they're in bloom and hopefully see a deer and some jackrabbits or some hummingbirds or whatever. But the legacy of that beautiful piece that's just ours in the Southwest. Yes. So your grandfather had foresight to preserve several of those really important legacies. That's really good.
Yeah. And then preserve, and that's an embodiment of what WMPA does as well, is that and Jim has inherited the position he has. He hopes, I'm sure, to pass it on to someone else eventually after hopefully a long while, because I think he's doing a great job. But it's an example of, and then you can think of, Ted was not particularly interested in the science when he was at the museum. That was more my mother thing, but he's eventually came to the environment, a different area.
So important area, Oceania. The oceans are disappearing oceans. They're not being preserved as well as some of our national parks, sorry to say.
So I guess about done.
We have 2 minutes. Hit us with your best shot.
All right, so let's just say that, so Edward Bridge Danson, Steward of the New West, it supports an academic chair in my grandfather's name. All profits go. I don't get a cent from anything sold.
Unbelievable. That's part of your legacy and important work that you're doing.
And it tells a story of one man coming to this region, how it changed his life and what he did. There are many more details. Hope she's mentioned future potential interviews and might be able to talk about more later. But it tells that story, and it along the way it shows how Arizona, the Southwest, changed around him. There are different aspects, different things, many different things have changed. And then also, if you want to know story of Ted's background, it does tell Ted. There are stories of Ted's adventures in here.
I think it's what I just want to make sure people leave with is how important it is that you wrote the book to preserve the history so that now we know it. You can get the book on Amazon.com. You can get it at the Western Parks Regional, the national headquarters in Oracle. Oro Valley, Arizona.
Do you have to go to the Museum of Northern Arizona? It's for sale there.
That's probably where I'm going to get mine. Have you back? Okay, thank you. Jim Cook, Executive Director of Western National Parks Association, WNPA.org, and Eric, your book on Amazon.com. Thank you for being here with us. Next week, we think we're going to have Ken Cook from the Environmental Working Group in Washington. He hasn't confirmed because of his schedule, but the Environmental Working Group from Washington, D.C. will be our guest next week. Make it a great green week. If you missed any of this, check out my website, Mrs. Green's World. The podcast will be available forever. Thank you two so much. We'll be hearing more from you.
Thank you.